Europe is complicated. Do you remember when Euronews was good? Previously in Europe, invadable Estonia. All right, Hugh, it's time for an election section, even though one of the things we're going to talk about isn't an election. And the other thing we're going to talk about isn't done being an election. Hooray!
Well, no, technically part of the election happened. As in, there
part
was
of
like
the
a...
election happened. That is a way of putting it. We are halfway through the cake that is the Czech presidential election.
Ooh, we're in the creamy middles now.
The creamy middles. The part that's all icing, because I saved that for last.
What's wrong with you?
What? Sponge is a waste of time. Icing is the best part of a cake.
Okay.
Anyway. So the Czech presidential election happened on January 12th, which was a Friday. This is the first round of the Czech election, though, not the second part, which will be happening on the 26th to 27th of January.
Mm-hmm. They have a runoff both system elections similar to France.
Yes, they have a two-round runoff system, unless someone gets like an outright majority in the first mm-hmm. round, but that didn't happen. Other thing they do, which is quite interesting, is they have two voting days, which is quite handy. Mm-hmm. Both the 12th and the 13th was a voting day in the Czech Republic, which makes kind of sense. You know, it's like, here's a Friday, and if you're busy working on Friday, here's a Saturday kind of thing. And that's kind of a nice system. I don't know. Anyway, the runoff election will be happening on the 26th between incumbent president Miloš Zeman, mm-hmm. I think I'm pronouncing that right, yep. and newcomer Jiří Drahoš. I believe you really pronounce the H in it. Which is very interesting because they're kind of polar opposites. They got about... the Zeman was in like mid-30s.
Yeah, I think it was 34 or something like that.
Yeah, and then high 20s for Drahoš. Mm-hmm. 26%, according to what I'm seeing here, yeah. The interesting thing, though, is that they're kind of polar opposites, while Zeman, the incumbent, kind of relies on siding, like, being anti-immigrant, mm-hmm. Particularly anti-Muslim immigration, which is relatively popular in the Czech Republic. He does some other things along with that people don't like. Such yes. as cuddling up to Vladimir Putin, which people in the Czech Republic are a little bit skeptical of siding politically with Russia due yes. to their history. That makes some sense. Similarly, he's also very right-wing himself and kind of cozies up to right-wing parties that like is quite divisive for a lot of the Czech Republic, namely for the people who don't like supporting the right-wing parties.
Yes.
Yeah.
Kind of alongside this, like he's very... he was the person when their current prime minister, Babish, came out on top in the parliamentary elections. His attitude at the time, Zeman's attitude at the time was, is Babish is currently being investigated for quite like it's quite old fraud now, but the EU was now like re-looking into misallocated or like EU funds that he applied for. And Zeman's attitude was, he'll be prime minister even if he's in jail. I'll still make him prime minister.
So this is actually an important thing to say about the president is that, like a lot of other European countries that have a president and a prime minister, the president's role is fairly ceremonial. Mm-hmm. But the president of the Czech Republic is the gatekeeper of like what governments form.
Yes.
You need approval from the president if you're forming government or if you want to be prime minister.
Yes. Even if the second round does go in his favor, there are now rumors circulating that because the investigations into Babish are still going. So there's concern where, so he doesn't have, his party doesn't have a majority in the parliament. It'll be, it's a, like a coalition and confidence supply deals set up. And if these investigations continue, there is a lot of speculation that there could just be a no confidence vote that he can't win because he actually does need support from other parties who don't agree with him on everything. And if kind of he's seen as a problematic figurehead, he might personally have to resign, which like Zeman would be very against. But at the moment needs to be is focused on his own election.
So interesting thing here now is about the opponent, or well, okay, sorry, I should say some other things about Draman, or not Draman, sorry, Zeman, yeah. And the other opinions that he's been gathering. So the fact that he's anti-EU is also divisive to the Czech Republic, because the Czech Republic itself doesn't seem to be too anti-EU. They're skeptical of the euro as a currency, but
yeah, that's beyond that's a different thing.
Yeah, they're able to detach that from the rest of their opinions to the EU. Mm. Yeah, his hard lines on like media freedom have been a concern to a lot of Czech people,
mm-hmm.
Including that event that we talked about previously in the show where he pulled out a fake gun that was labeled "for journalists" on it after Babiš won the election.
Yeah, but the gun also shot a Jägermeister, so I mean, maybe he just thought they needed to loosen up.
Maybe he's just a party dude. I knew I should have worn that Hawaiian shirt.
Yeah.
At the same time, that event in particular called into question his health, and particularly his mental health, whether he was still fit to be president.
Yeah.
Which is a concern to a lot of the Czech public. His opponent, Drahos, is like former head of the Science Society. In the Czech Republic, he's a chemist trained, and he became a politician. Very academic, very pro-Western, pro-EU. Yeah, that would be kind of what he stands on, like the ground he stands on. And the opinion polls are showing that he's probably going to win.
Yep.
By a very, very small percentage, but the opinion polling has been consistent since. So again, like any country that has a two-round voting system, they do votes where they're like, what about this person with that person, etc. Mm-hmm, and they poll enough people on it. So they've been doing these polls since like April last year.
Mm-hmm.
And only one poll, Jiří Drahos didn't win. And there's another poll where he tied, but that's it. Winning by somewhere between 4 points to 11 points.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, it looks like from some of the reports I'm reading that basically everyone who voted for any other candidate is going to vote against the incumbent Miloš Zeman.
Yeah. Oh, the joy of the additional proportionality brought with multi-round systems.
Yes, yeah. Oh, dear. But yeah, that seems to be the Czech election at the moment. Other than that, Zeman, as a incumbent, was refusing to do any debates.
Yeah,
for a very, very long time, up until the results were revealed, I believe today, that they were able to say with confidence, now that like they've counted X amount of seats and, you know, regions, whatever, that the two candidates are going to be Zeman and Drahos.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like, Zeman has now agreed for a 1v1 debate against Drahos, which a lot of people are not confident he's capable of really doing.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of like systems where it's like the norm to have debates, and that like refusing to do them would now be quite problematic. Mm-hmm. And for like instituting a system where like it's mandatory to have debates or to show up to like some sort of Hustian style situation, because like I think that was really notable in the French presidential election, where like individually campaigning, Le Pen can seem not crazy, but on giving a stump speech, she can prepare it if she's not knows she could just not take questions, or like it can be in an interview with some friendly journalists, for instance, and you can seem quite measured and if you've pre-prepared statements. But if it's kind of a debate format where you actually have to engage, and her response was how she normally engages with people in like as an MEP, etc., which is trying to shout people down, trying to grandstand, saying stuff that doesn't really make any sense or pan out once she actually starts saying it. And you're like, oh, like you could definitely get an impression of Le Pen as not an unstable figure, until you make her actually talk one-on-one with Macron, who was very chill, and then it's like, well, actually, Le Pen looks like a crazy person. Seemingly, Z-Man would probably try and do something like grandstandy, like not bring a fake gun onto stage necessarily, but
also not that.
Yeah, like, as in, he strikes me as the kind of person who'd come up with like crazy gotcha moments that don't actually make any sense. Which is similar to what ended up happening like in the last Irish presidential election. There were people who like seemed like perfectly reasonable candidates, but then once they actually had to like talk live on television with the other candidates around, they immediately seemed like crazy people.
Yes, it's always fun when that happens in politics.
Yes.
Yeah, debates are important. Also, I disagree with another thing that's been happening, particularly in the UK elections, where these pseudo debates happen.
Yeah, no, I don't like... Well, yeah, I think that's they're fine as long as you also have debates, but it's like...
Oh, yeah, in addition to debates, they're a lovely addition, like the town hall things that they do, but not just that.
Yes. I think there's, like, the very valid arguments that people have of, like, modern television debates aren't, like, debates as you would... If you were to come up with a debate format, you would never land on what most of them end up being, where you have, like, you have 2 minutes to respond to this question, and this person has 1 minute to rebut in some cases, but not as, like, a complicated format like that, but you could definitely put together. I just want that West Wing episode in the final season where they're like, we're going to have a real debate, and they just, like, off-the-cuff talk and debate about things. But that wouldn't work with, like, Z-Man, for instance, probably.
Have you seen my journalism gun? How do you hate yourself?
Z-Man, stop bringing that up.
I like Zeman's debate strategy of everyone has to have 3 shots of Jaeger before getting on stage.
That also would be fine. I think you should enshrine that stuff in law,
constitution,
like in the electoral guidelines of like you can't not you're like obliged as like the candidate for president or leader of your party to attend a debate or send someone on your behalf. Anyway.
Yeah. Oh dear. Moving on to the thing that's not quite an election, but still is going to impact a lot of things, is the Bulgaria is now in charge of the EU's rotating presidency.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's a thing, and this was problematic from the get-go because Bulgaria is fairly right wing at the moment, in terms of government. Like their party that's leading at the moment is a party that I always love the name of, because if I pronounce it in English, it's GERB. It stands for something, and it doesn't look like GERB when it's spelt in Cyrillic, but it looks like GERB. Anyway, they're your standard center right kind of party. They're a member of the EPP, etc. But they are being propped up by a far-right, ultra-nationalist, almost fascist party. So people are a little concerned about that. There's also been things regarding, like, Bulgaria's anti-migration crackdown has maybe gone a little too far with a lot of empowering of citizen groups to, like, patrol the border and just... arrest brown people. There's been a lot of cases where they've arrested people that weren't like Syrian migrants trying to cross the border. They were like other, you know, sometimes even Bulgarians.
Yeah. Groups running like kind of if you have enough, if your hobby is spending your free time patrolling your country's border looking for migrants, like, that's probably a red flag of you wouldn't be hired by a company, like, as in by the country themselves to do this job because you like it too much, perhaps?
You stand to be a bit more dispassionate.
Yes.
The Bulgarian president also, Rumen Radev, who is not the head of the country, again, it's like a president, like, in Ireland, in the Czech Republic, he vetoed a anti-corruption bill recently, 2nd of January, which only a day after they received their rotating 6-month EU presidency. So that wasn't received well, even though the bill was approved by Parliament. So We're like, why is the president doing this? There was a lot huge scale protests recently because other things. I think that the situation on the ground is that the Bulgarian government is using their rotating EU presidency to distract the Bulgarian people from a handful of things they're doing internally. Like vetoing the anti-corruption bill and also approving logging in a national park.
Right.
Yeah. It's also a UNESCO, it's Pirin National Park. This is what the protests in particular were about. Pirin National Park, UNESCO World Heritage Site, has been approved for partial commercial logging to make way for a ski resort. Yeah, so that resulted in a protest from environmentalists and Friends of the Earth Europe kind of helped organize it, but it also attracted people protesting general corruption and like disapproval of the government. The summit happened where they like Boyko Borisov, who's the prime minister, formally welcomed like everyone into, you know, the country, being like, hey, we're doing, you know, this rotating presidency stuff. And they talked about being a bridge between East and West and trying to cool relations with Russia and Turkey, which for some Europeans, that's a bit of a red flag. but overall, it went quite well. Jean-Claude Juncker using the opportunity to support Bulgaria's accession into the Schengen free travel zone and into the euro single currency. Yeah, but overall it was it's kind of a weird one, as yeah, people are generally unhappy with what Bulgaria is doing, but they're only a country of like 7 million, so a lot of people don't really talk about it.
It's kind of like in I think the government's doing less headline grabbing things than like Romania, who are in similar, like in a similar position in general, in terms of EU relationships, and there's less like very publicly, like very large public protests and obvious power grabs from the government. There are some, but they're maybe successfully distracting from them better.
Yeah, I think it's also like an international scale type of thing, because Romania has like what, an extra 20 million people compared to Bulgaria? Something like that. So they're like 26 million population, whereas Bulgaria is like 7 million. Yeah, so there's a scale thing as well, I think, to consider. And we can also talk about the slightly worrying, like, welcome to Bulgaria ad they did on Twitter.
I think that ad would be fine if you... I think that's a great example of... if you already know the reference you're making, it doesn't seem offensive. But if you don't, if you're not familiar enough with Bulgaria, it seems very sketchy. So the problem with it was it, very early on in the ad, it says Bulgaria, where no might mean yes.
It was specifically where her no might mean yes.
Pointing
to a very attractive young woman.
Yeah, but it's kind of like the ad is following like two people who meet on a train and then, like, go exploring Bulgaria together. And the joke is on, if you shake your head from side to side in Bulgaria, that means, like, what we do for nodding. It's, like, the other way around. It's similar in, like, Turkey and quite a few other places.
Yeah,
it's
so just shaking like, your head in Bulgaria means yes, and nodding means
so,
no.
So, like, the scene is supposed to be, he says something, she shakes her head, he's like, oh, you mean no, and she's like, oh, no, what a hilarious misunderstanding. But with just the voiceover, and the shot of her is only, like, a couple of frames, so it's not actually clear if you're not paying close attention and also already know the Bulgaria head shaking thing.
That
they're not
really
just being like,
you.
Consent doesn't matter in Bulgaria. Which is pretty
dark. I am Prime Minister Boyko Borisov, former bodyguard to the Soviet era communist dictator, and I approve this message. I'm like, oh no.
There are so many bits of that statement that I find uncomfortable.
Moving away from Bulgaria.
Yeah, so that kind of blew up on Twitter a bit. I think it was very much like a there are a number of factors that I can see why the people making this wouldn't have realized that this would be a problem.
Yes, yeah.
Because they were like,
it was genuinely an honest mistake.
Yeah, like, you could definitely see how you'd be like, you didn't mean it was a bad consent, but it really sounds like it is. Anyway, problem.
Oh, dear.
Bulgaria, man. Moving to Germany, where people mean what they say and are stern about it. Yeah, so there's been an agreement between the SPD leaders and the CDU, Merkel's party and Schulz's party, not respectively, the other way around, that they have a outline of how a coalition could work to bring back the Grand Coalition, and they basically now need their various memberships to agree to it, and then go back into negotiations to actually work out the more fine details. Yeah, it's kind of like it brings up a lot of the bigger problems that between the two groups, because they both went in kind of saying like the Conservatives want to go more fiscally conservative and the SPD want to go more economically liberal, so they're kind of like, oh, we want to raise taxes on very wealthy people, but the CDU are saying, oh, well, that might be fine, but we want to dramatically lower corporation tax. So,
where I get that money from.
But yeah, they didn't really like offer a lot of details about exactly what this, what exactly like the details of the deal are. But Schulz seems very enthusiastic about it. Merkel seems to be pushing it as well. So yeah, I guess we'll see. Probably this week there'll be some stuff coming out of it.
As of Friday, there was some statements made by Merkel and SPD spokespeople that like it's looking good, but it as Hugh said off mic before we started recording, he suspects it will blow up, or this will come back to negotiations in some way, and it won't really.
I think it'll be like there'll be some version of. I think there'll probably be some version of Grand Coalition, but you know.
Not necessarily this version.
Exactly. There's been polling that show that if they had another election, for instance, that basically nothing would change. So there'd be no point doing it.
Yeah.
I think, from a logical point of view, the only reason to go back for another election is if you think there'll actually be a change. So, up some level. Anyway, moving on to Catalonia, where the separatist parties, which together make up, a majority in the parliament, have decided to re-elect Puigdemont as the regional leader. One of the parties there had to send not their main leader to the negotiations because the leader is still in jail despite being re-elected. Anyway, the problem of this is that Puigdemont is still in Brussels and has said that he thinks it's not possible currently to return to Catalonia because, as far as he knows, and the central government have strongly hinted at this, that if he were to return to Catalonia, they would arrest him. And his plan, so the parliament's going to reconvene on Tuesday, and his plan is to join the parliament by video link or have his speech read by somebody.
Interesting.
I like the idea of telepresence Puigdemont running the parliament for the next couple of years.
Reminds me of that council in V for Vendetta.
Yes. Or Evangelion, similarly.
Chances are Marta Rovira, who's the second in command, is probably who we're going to see more from over the coming weeks, months, possibly.
I think, there's always talks about in countries that have relatively frequent live video feeds from their parliaments, that the problem is often, it's not interesting to watch, largely because it's always shocking how few people show up to regular debates frequently in the parliament. And they're the defense of that often is if we were to attend every debate and go to everything, we would have no time to do anything else. At which point we'd be very uninformed and not ever go to our constituencies, etc. However, you could have something telepresence for all members of parliaments in various parliaments that you have to put in a certain number of total hours in the parliament to be eligible for your salary or something.
Yeah, it'd be very interesting because the idea of representatives in parliament is that they're meant to represent your area or your people or whoever the parliament is split. But when you look at the French parliament, where they have people from French Guiana and the Pacific Islands that France still controls, reporting into the parliament, you're how? You like live in Paris for most of. How do you know what life in like Reunion Island off the coast of Madagascar is like anymore?
Yes, so you could have more telepresence, is what I'm saying. And, yes, and I want them to be in that version of an iPad on wheels.
I was going to suggest a giant screen fitted to the ceiling that overlooks everything, and if we could have like some smoke machines around it, that would also be great.
That would be good. That would be great. I'm on board. We'll call that the Poojimot rule.
Poojibots.
And now for the miscellaneous section, where we didn't feel like categorizing these things into smaller sections, so we're lumping them all together. First, there's Oettinger, the EU commissioner for the budget, I believe is his title, yes, has made a statement that due to Brexit and like ongoing EU plans, even with money coming from the UK, even though that might be unreliable, instead of some sort of EU program austerity, he wants to use this as a opportunity to get rid of the current spending cap, which is 1% of the gross national income of all the EU wealthiest countries, I think is the it's of each country, and this is kind of heavily pushed by the UK and Germany and France and other wealthier members, because they don't want to end up having to. But like, as in, if you did it as a percentage of GDP, their bill dramatically increases, like monetarily, because their GDP is so high. So there was a cap connected to that. And Oettinger wants to change it to increase the EU budget by around 10%. That would make, so basically to allow for keeping the budget sort of as it is, but with the UK out, and then all the like other countries will see more money coming in. There's a lot of like rumblings about how people aren't going to like this, including Italy were initially very standoffish about this as a concept. I'm just see where this goes, because like there's kind of all the talk about what Brexit like divorce settlement will be reached monetarily with the UK, and it's like, even after the UK is gone, are you going to start cutting percentages off EU programs that required a certain amount of money, or how are you going to fund the ones that are already running without like, you know, cutting back significantly? Because some of it is stuff that's the not having to like pay out to the UK will make stuff cheaper, but there is like an economies of scale aspect to an awful lot of EU programs that kind of require a fixed amount of money. Interesting to see what will happen with that. But we know what Oettinger's solution is. I want more money.
I feel like what we do is, once the UK leaves, we chorus Norway and all their delicious oil money to join.
Norway and their delicious oil money. Yes. There's been a big overhaul of the Polish cabinet. The relatively new Polish prime minister, Morawiecki, yes, I think that's what we agreed we were going to call him. He dismissed quite a few of his cabinet ministers. This has largely been seen as a kind of placation somewhat to the EU, because a lot of these people that he's getting rid of and replacing are people who are problematic when you sent them to EU negotiations and meetings, and kind of this is like the PIS is in a, the ruling party is in a good position like electorally locally in Poland, but like they are kind of hitting continuous like they're kind of grinding against the EU quite a bit lately, especially like publicly anyway, with high-ranking Polish officials saying what could be classed as stupid things that the Polish government has to somewhat backtrack on. And kind of this is seen as kind of a, how can we do what the PIS wants to do locally while also being friendly with the EU, because we get a lot out of them. I guess this is kind of somewhat against the... I don't know. I don't know if I'd call it a narrative, but I feel like there is kind of an implication in a lot of English language press anyway that the PIS is very Eurosceptic, which isn't true. And it's not like it's like explicitly said. It just seems like a lot of the newsworthy stuff that like matters to other EU countries coming out of Poland is when they say stuff or do stuff that the EU is looking into. And there is the whole like Article 8 in like implementation.
Article 7, you mean?
Sorry, Article 7. God damn it.
Yeah.
too many numbers. Yeah, there's the whole Article 7 like kicking off stuff as well that like could potentially down the road like restrict Polish voting rights in the EU, but it's kind of the consensus very much is like we don't want it to come to that, and the PIS don't want it to come to that. Whereas if you were really Eurosceptic, they would be, you know, pushing for referendums and stuff. It's not.
Yeah, there's on that scale. I feel like it's kind of when it's the European context, when other European countries are talking about another European country, they look. It's not a objective scale as such. They look at what is the most Eurosceptic party that has a chance of ruling.
Yeah, like, right, yeah.
So it's kind of like UKIP is the most Eurosceptic party in the UK, although you can argue how much of a chance they have of ruling, but they get power as like in a vague term. The PIS is definitely Poland's most Eurosceptic party that has a chance of ruling. Because I feel similarly when I read other countries write about Sinn Féin within the Republic of Ireland. They often brought up how Eurosceptic they were, but they're not really at all. Like, not anymore.
Yeah, right, exactly. And yeah, that was very much like some people in the party somewhat higher up were skeptical about the EU's, like, you know, pro-business attitudes. It wasn't like we want out of the EU immediately to have our socialist utopia.
Yes, and they've also like buried that quite a bit over the years because Ireland is an incredibly pro-EU country.
Yeah.
But they are definitely the most Eurosceptic. Because of all that, they're the most Eurosceptic party in Ireland that has a chance
of having say. I think that's very true. And I think on a similar level, it's taking a look at all the developments of the Polish government, and you're like, why does this matter to someone in Germany?
Yeah.
If you don't live in East Germany near Poland, it probably only matters if it's like a big departure from like how the rest of Europe is behaving. And some of the stuff they are doing is notable and quite like right wing and would be problematic in terms of clashing with other EU directives and laws. But it's a overall, like, the entire PIS aren't like, they're not UKIP or something.
No.
In terms of like dislike for Europe, kind of going moving on, like, or yeah, staying with that, the European Parliament vice president, whose name I'm going to butcher in a minute, Rizard Karzenecki, close enough.
I think it's Czarnecki.
Czarnecki. Like Czarnecki. Yeah. Okay. Yes. There's like calls from four of the big voting blocs in the EU Parliament to get him to step down as vice president of the Parliament, because he likened another Polish MEP to the Polish Nazi collaborators. Of the late 30s. So basically this is like, I think this is an example of my previous point, which is he's a member of the PIS and he's the vice president of the European Parliament, who the leadership of the European Parliament, you'll be shocked to find out, are overall pro-European Parliament.
Imagine that.
I think we were talking before this about kind of how, like, this isn't necessarily notable, and I think it's well known that he doesn't get on well with the other Polish MEPs from other parties, who the Polish government is now kind of, you know, making statements of Donald Tusk, who is like, you know, a member of the like big Polish opposition party, kind of a keep your nose out of local Polish politics. You're like Europe focused. You shouldn't make local comments. You're not in the
Like, there's some language has like escalated to the words of like traitor,
yeah,
etc. Like, the it's weird that the main opposition, this is part and parcel of what mostly scares me of Poland, is that we have a far right, or like further right, however you want to describe it, right wing party leading the country, and their main opposition is the center right party.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, because
the
thing, like, yeah, Tusk,
viciously hate each other sometimes.
Yeah, like Tusk isn't, you know, far left or something. It's not. No. They disagree on like more finer grain stuff in a lot of ways, or it's kind of they have some very far right views that Tusk wouldn't go along with, and kind of wouldn't have been a discussion point when he was there. And a lot of the stuff that's getting that, like, during last year, we're getting like large protests in Poland. They weren't the kind. They were just kind of like, you know, more extreme. They were more extreme versions of anything they would ever come up with. Tusk being in power.
Yeah, but yeah. So the reason, like, as Hugh was kind of saying, the comment itself is kind of like, this isn't really news. Someone just said something, but there has been a response to this. Tajani, the leader of the EPP, has kind of like denounced Czarnecki's possibly, I don't know, comments as unacceptable and a degrading statement. And then, like, various members of the other parliamentary groups have also demanded that this vice president, Czarnecki, has like should step down. So yeah, stuff's happening because of it. It's not just some sort of weird comment that someone has said and then nothing happened. Speaking of weird, horrifying things, on Turkey's Black Sea coast today, as we record, a plane overshot its like runway and started, because the runway is right up against a very like steep cliff, not like a 100, like not like a 90 degree drop, but like, I don't know, 85 degree angle kind of thing. It resulted in the plane just slowly slipping down the side of it.
Yeah, that's a... Yeah.
It took hours into the Black Sea. I genuinely, like, look up photos of this. It's the airport is Trabzon. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. T-R-A-B-A-Z-O-N.
Yeah. Put a link to this in the episode description, because need to see, like, there's like photos from the runway perspective. Effectively, you can just see the tail of the plane sticking up from a cliff, and then like aerial photos, like, you can see that it's like a steep incline more than a cliff, but like it'd be unclear how you would get the plane back up.
No, like, so far they've managed to get all 162 passengers out of that.
Yeah.
But I don't think the plane is coming back.
No. Well, I mean, they have to do something with it.
I mean, yeah, they can't leave it there, but...
No.
Yeah, it's such an interesting... it's very shocking imagery.
Yeah.
Recommend you look that.
I'm sure there were people who were circling that airport for a significant amount of time, and the pilot would just have to be like... there's been a landing accident of some description. I don't want to get into details. It'll distress you.
I really shouldn't have said the word accident.
Yeah. This is the kind of thing that, like, I like flying, but I think I've never had to fly into one of, like, any airports where... I always find it disconcerting when you're flying, like, you're landing into an airport and you come, like, very close to, a highway. Like, in a lot of airports, especially I find in the States, there's, like, highways, like, very close to the runway. I think one of the Heathrow terminals is like this as well. And it's kind of, it's disconcerting of, I don't think we're going to hit that it's quite a small, like, in the grand scheme of things, you know, clearance. And then you get all those airports in Hong Kong where they fly in between buildings and stuff. And you're like, it's the tiny errors that I'm scared of. It's not the really stupid, like, dramatic plane disasters. It's the, yeah, but what if our plane sort of missed the runway a bit and ended up sliding down a cliff?
Yeah, I flew into a small airport in Donegal once where the runway is like built on reclaimed land in the sea. It's just like a rectangle jutting out from the coast that you land on.
Great.
Yeah, it's really great.
You know what else is great? Being Sebastian Kurz, the Prime Minister of Austria. So he's
Chancellor.
Sorry, Chancellor. Yeah, well, that's Prime Minister. Technically, yeah. Sort of, I guess. Anyway, so his Vice Chancellor, now that he's gone to government with the FPÖ, the Freedom Party of Austria, and you might ask the question, weren't like, are Austria not free? Is that what you're getting at? And parties with those kind of names do tend to be very far right.
Yeah.
So now that he's kind of gone into government with them, he's now running into the problems of, oh, when like the lead, like your vice chancellor, Heinz Christian Strache,
yes,
anyway, close enough, says crazy things, it's no longer like your political opponent saying them, and you can kind of come up with a more palatable version of it. He's your vice chancellor, and you have to make comments on it.
I particularly love the photo of Heinz Christian on this article of Heinz Christian Strache just like making the speech, possibly delivering what you're about to say he's delivering, while Sebastian Kurz is to the side being like, no, no.
It's also great because Strache is like, you know, looks like a regular, like a normal politician. He's kind of looks like he's probably in his 40s, maybe 50s, like, yeah, kind of wearing it like a nice suit. Kurz is like, what, 32? He looks like a child standing next to this man who's just like, oh, what have I done?
Dad, stop it. Yeah,
you're embarrassing me in front of the international press. So he proposed, he kind of like said that it wouldn't be a terrible idea to have refugees housed in military barracks and then impose a nighttime curfew on them.
Uh-huh.
Which, from his point of view, like in the grand scheme of stuff that he says, this is like both technically implementable and like not as crazy as the stuff, other stuff he says, but like, yeah, also not good.
it's definitely one of the more FPO's moderate views. You can also see how it's a step towards their crazier views.
Yeah, so this strikes me as they had a talk where it was, okay, we're in government now, we can't be saying really crazy stuff because people will expect us to do them. So now, yeah, he's doing stuff that he's saying things that he sees as the really moderate version of his other views.
Yes.
Which still seems nuts. Yeah.
On top of that, thousands of Austrians took to the streets of Vienna on Saturday to protest against their country's new right-wing government. For whatever reason, who could discern this?
It's as if they might be an embarrassment on the world stage.
They might be coming up with, I don't know, camps of sorts. Military guarded camps. The new governing coalition, made up the Conservative Austrian People's Party and the National Freedom Party, has taken a hard line against migration and refugees, which might be putting it lightly.
In better news, Estonia can no longer be completely occupied within days. It would take weeks. Yeah, so this is Estonia's defense forces kind of announcing, saying that it's now much more difficult than it used to be to invade Estonia, which, I mean, you know, good news. But he also brought up some interesting stuff that about kind of around, there's a lot of discussion around people who won't be mentioned complaining about NATO members not pulling their weight. And not adhering to the 2% of the country's GDP on defense spending guidance number that they come up with, that they're technically supposed to be doing, but most, like a lot of the countries are saying that it's infeasible. The general who announced that Estonia is now more difficult to invade than it previously was, has said that this actually wouldn't be necessarily useful, because currently they have the problem, like a lot of world militaries have the problem of stuff like ammunition isn't stuff that you can just like go purchase and there's large stocks of it waiting for you to purchase at any time. It's kind of you contract a company to manufacture this for you in a lot of those cases. So like it's similar, it's like a similar thing with airlines when they announce they're going to buy a fleet of airplanes. There's not like a waiting fleet for them to purchase in most cases. It's they're saying to the airline or the manufacturer that we will buy these if you go manufacture them for us now because where are they going to keep loads of airplanes? Similar with stuff like weapons. It's in most cases it's not really practical for you to do stuff like that. So it's kind of he was saying that like they're gear up to improve their defenses in recent years have now run into the problem where they're not quite spending 2% of their GDP, but as in if they were, that would just be money that was just sitting around not being used because they're still waiting for stuff to tick along that they've already planned. So room for nuance with stuff like military spending.
Yeah, fair enough, but you know, good for Estonia and their no longer invadability.
Well, no, it's still, let's be clear, you could still invade Estonia. It would just take longer.
All right, going into a possible stronger collection of countries. So the summit of Mediterranean European countries happened this weekend, I believe, or this past week. It lasted for a while. And it's important for several reasons. I've talked about these like European groupings before and how much I like them, and you know, I like watching what moves they make and etc. etc. It's what I enjoy about European politics. But last time we talked about it, they were going by the name Club Med, which you had real problems with
because Club Med is the name of a large multinational corporation.
That's fair, but now Euronews has said enough is enough. We are going to call them the Med 7.
I like it.
Yes, in reference to the fact that there are 7 Mediterranean countries: Italy, Portugal, Cyprus, Spain, Malta, France, and Greece. But they kind of they undermine this by halfway through their article going, meeting in Rome this time, the group dubbed the Club Med by the press of common emergencies such as that of migration. I was like, oh damn it. Yeah, this went on for a long time, mainly because things like how Macron was already in like Rome before the summit happened. So there was press conferences from like Macron and the Italian premier being like, we really want to push the EU to take migration more seriously, which is, you know, one of their common allying factors. And that's pretty much what came out of the summit as well. All of the countries agreed that migration needs to be dealt with more seriously.
Yeah. The push from the Mediterranean countries is it's very different to the anti-immigrant tendencies of like
Central Europe,
which is kind of we want to protect our borders and like the EU should sort out this like migration problem, whereas the South are like, it's not physically feasible for us to keep out all immigration because they can come via the sea. So when they get here, what do you want us to do? Because they're not their intended destination, and we have to do something with them. So further north countries like kicking the can down the road and refusing to take refugees now is effectively saying the South has to take most of them, because Germany can take in as many as they want, but it's not going to be all of them, and it's not the point of arrival.
No, you need more countries doing what Germany did to a certain extent. To not paint with too broad a brush, Sweden has done similar things. I think Ireland has also exceeded its like the agreed upon number that it agreed with the EU, not by a huge amount, but it did, which, considering most other countries are refusing to meet those targets, it's like, okay, fair enough.
Yeah, but there's a current scandal going on in Ireland with their refugee camps, or the management of the refugee camps are being done via private contractors who also run private prisons in America. So it's kind of, let's not give Ireland too much credit.
No. If anyone wants to be angry at Ireland, I recommend Googling the term direct provision. It's really hideous. And it's really interesting that like everyone in the county of Mayo is like really for like migration and refugee reform in mm-hmm. Ireland
yeah.
because that's where all the camps are. Yeah. And they're like, we see what it looks like. It's awful.
Yeah.
Anyway, the thing though that was in, I found a bit more interesting though, because, you know, the Med 7 agreeing on like pushing migration reform and like coming from a European wide, if not Mediterranean wide solution to this, that was expected from any and all like Mediterranean summits for the foreseeable future. However, stuff that did come out of it that's a bit more surprising is that they agreed upon the idea of combined security, mm-hmm. Security and defense, education and culture, like the idea of working together to preserve a certain aspect of what they share in terms of culture. There's some like overlap with mm-hmm. a lot of these countries,
yeah,
because they were one Aragon used to own a lot of Italy, and it's Spain now, and Naples, and all that. There's a lot of like overlap anyway, but the more interesting one that I thought is they're talking now about a common budget for all members,
mm-hmm.
With the Mediterranean. So since it was like bit of a public airy fairy, you know, summit, they're not obviously going to talk with the details of that, but
yeah,
if they actually are serious about that. And I know a lot of the southern European countries are also the countries in favor of like a united European fiscal policy,
because
mm-hmm. they're like the ones being like, no, we need to be able to like lend or like borrow money,
yeah,
to like stop horrifying austerity practices in our countries.
Fun.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to the Enid Blyton books on the Med 7. It's like a more tan Secret 7.
Oh, that'd be great.
solving budgetary mysteries.
Penelope Gate, as solved by Enid Blyton.
For the glorious return of the not news section, where we talk about stuff Whee! That isn't really news and but seems to be shown as news. The first bit I want to talk about is Euronews is no longer news.
Euronews is becoming slightly trashy,
and by slightly trashy we mean like very trashy in kind of like a, and quite suddenly, like as in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah,
I feel like
between
Yeah.
very much between this episode and the last episode where we covered the news.
Mm. And so like,
yeah,
I noticed this because happened. Like the way I collect stuff for this podcast is usually through our RSS feed. So like I see everything that gets posted on websites that I subscribe to, and yeah. my Euronews, the feed for Euronews seems to have like, I would say gone up by like 20-30%, and the increase is all down to syndicated content from NBC, who own quite a big chunk of Euronews, but previously it was very much like if there was a Europe related or like very very important US story, it seemed to be a piece written by an NBC correspondent, whereas now it seems to be like stuff that has the NBC logo on it that just gets posted on the Euronews website. And
yeah,
I guess like looking at their homepage, it doesn't seem like that much has changed really, but if you're receiving like everything that gets posted on the site in order, the quantity of US only focused stuff, especially like minor stuff Trump says that isn't actually important, or isn't really even getting, like it's getting sensationalist like 24-hour news coverage in America, but it's not getting like substantive coverage, is kind of making its way onto Euronews in quite an obnoxious way. And apparently, so some people I know who still watch television news, the Euronews TV channel has had a similar shift. It now will suddenly go between just Euronews content and then seemingly randomly switch over to something US focused. And it's just even like the tone of like reporting of like a reporter like calmly explaining something or like calmly writing about something on Euronews, and then switches to NBC, which is much more of what you need to do to be competitive in the US news environment, which is like you feel like people are shouting at you or the headline is very not indicative of what the piece is about.
Yeah. Similarly, there's been like some website problems. So I gather news in much the same way. I have RSS feeds. I keep track of all this kind of stuff. And Euronews is not my only source, but I did try to go through all my Euronews stuff recently, and it took me about 3 hours to like just discard all the US stuff.
Right.
That, yeah, like through a relatively large feed. And that was quite annoying. The next problem is a slight like problem with their website, where they now have a little drawbar on the right-hand side of their website that is a live feed update of every comment made on every article.
Yes, which is not a good idea.
No, I don't understand what website thought they're like, oh, the comment section, that's the best part of our website. A lot of like a lot of the words globalist and EU-SSR was written and stuff like that. You know, very, very informed political comments.
The kind you get on, like, below the, like, in the comment section deep down on any website. You wouldn't want a live stream of everything. I think it's, like, it's trying to make news website, like, doing something like that. Like, I understand having comments on pieces. That's, like, you know, works sometimes it works a bit less. If it's a controversial piece, maybe you want to take off the comment section. But like having a live feed of them continuously is trying to make Euronews like Twitter, which isn't like isn't what I used it for.
It's what no one uses it for.
Well, yeah, well, we don't know that for sure. I'm sure very few. Yeah. Like again, Euronews would be one of the few news sources that I read frequently would kind of, if it did a human interest story, it'd be like a niche European thing. Whereas now there's peppered in slightly clickbaity, like, you won't believe what happened in this, like, obscure American town where this, like, weird court case is going on. And you're like, oh, that's not a European nor relevant news to me.
The other thing that was good about Euronews was it was fairly comprehensive. It came with videos, which as a visual learner, is a lot easier for me to retain that information. but at the same time, it was all very calm.
Which is what I like in my news sources.
Yeah, the problem, I remember like having Euronews. So in Ireland for a long time, the only two 24-hour like news channels that you got was the British channel Sky News, which was owned by Rupert Murdoch, and Euronews. And no one watched Euronews because it was boring.
Rupert Murdoch doesn't own Sky News, by the way. just let
what?
You know.
Yeah, no, he tried to buy Sky, didn't he? Something?
Yeah, and he failed. They're trying again.
Oh,
but the whole thing of, like, as in, they're, it will, so if it was Fox was is trying to purchase B Sky B, which is the company that runs Sky Television across Europe, because there's Sky in loads of countries, and Sky News is owned directly by that. The like Fox has like a 20 something percent stake in it now, and they wanted a controlling share, and that was what was trying to be. That's what they abandoned for a while, and then brought back, and UK ombudsman were looking into whether or not the deal could go through. But now Fox is getting sold to Disney, so what would actually happen would be, if the deal goes through, Disney will own Sky. So as in, there is no longer a setup, unless the Disney deal ends up not happening, there's no longer a setup where Rupert Murdoch will be the CEO of a company that directly owns Sky News. So like the thing is, like, Sky News is a lot more like, if you compare it to like, if you compare like Sky, like if Rupert Murdoch owned Sky News, they wouldn't do a Tomorrow's Papers where they talk about the Guardian. They'd cut it out. It would definitely have more of an agenda,
more tame than Fox News. Don't get me wrong, but
it's not even on the same like on the same scale at all, and that like the editorial control of Sky News does genuinely seem to be with the people who run it and not with like a magical outside force that is like pushing a very serious agenda. While the people who run it might be more like right-leaning than you or me, it's not like a crazy biased news source, which Fox News in America like very frequently makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah. Just to slightly counter that, though, in the last couple of years, the Sky News channel has been adding more opinion-driven shows.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, definitely.
Hour to 2 hour segments where they're doing something very similar to what Fox News has been doing in the States, where they have like this one person put on this pedestal giving their takes of the day.
Yes.
Type of thing.
Yeah.
And they are, and it's very visually similar to what their actual like news broadcasts are like, which I always think is a dangerous thing for like a 24-hour news channel to do.
Yeah.
And they're quite right-leaning. Nowhere near Fox, but Fox is on a different plane. But yeah, you're right. You're right. Sorry. Yeah, I forgot that deal never went through.
But also like on top of that, it's the like a lot of the talk now seems to be, well, like Sky News is almost certainly doing that out of like for business reasons, not for agenda pushing reasons, largely based on Sky News, for as far as people can tell, isn't making money. And there's a lot of talk of if it were the reason that a deal to purchase BSkyB didn't go through, they would just say, that's fine, we'll close it down. Because the people who run Sky now have said that if like the purchase doesn't go through and it stays a like independent company with multiple interests, they're like, well, there's no guarantee we'll keep Sky News open. It's very expensive to run. It doesn't make any money. Like a lot of the feeling from it. So like kind of that is a potential way to like draw in more viewers. Anyway, moving on, talking about Sky News for soon to be Disney owned Sky News isn't news. On a similar level, Nigel Farage and Aaron Banks, the bankroller of UKIP for a long time, have made comments saying that they'd be cool with a second Brexit referendum, largely from a position of that way everyone who is complaining about the referendum being close or not being actually the will of what people actually voted for is, well, that's fine, let's have another referendum. They seem pretty confident it would be fine, but I think they're saying this because they know there's probably not going to be one.
Another
potential angle of it is that they're saying it because they're now realizing that what they actually wanted from leaving the EU isn't gonna happen, because there'll be some sort of trade negotiation with the EU that will get like keep some of the aspects of it that they don't like, which they're like, well, we would rather have just stayed in if that's what we were getting. Anyway, the opinions of Nigel Farage and Moneybags
Banks
are like,
you can't call him Moneybag Banks when his last name is Banks. It's just too, I feel like it's redundant. I don't know,
you're redundant. I don't know if this in itself isn't news. I think people jumped on and kind of like, oh look, they're so hypocritical, or like, oh, this is a big like U-turn from Farage. But it's I think from his perspective, he's probably just like, if anyone had asked me before, I would have said yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's not too controversial, especially if the whole statement is, yeah, have a second referendum. I think that would also pass, like, from his perspective, like, it would pass as a leave. I unfortunately kind of agree with him.
Based on polling data, relatively safe waters to be in. To say that if there was another Brexit referendum, like very, 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 very soon, or if there was like a relatively okay deal from the EU, then yeah, that probably would go through.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, but it's not going to happen because Farage and Aaron Banks don't actually have any conceivable power other than like swaying public opinion. And they're not trying to drastically sway public opinion here. They're just being like, yeah, have as many referendums as you want. If you remember correctly, we're the ones who called for the referendum in the first place.
Yeah.
So, and why do you consider this a weird position to buy?
Yeah, right, exactly. Like, yeah. I think because there, I think there's like a good statement. I think I'm gonna attribute this to David Axelrod, the guy who helped run Ed Miliband's failed bid for prime minister, and but was like one of the masterminds behind the Obama campaigns. Is just, you're never as smart as you look when you win, and you're never as stupid as you look when you lose, which is, people are like, oh, Nigel Farage really like was on the pulse of the British people, and is like, but he couldn't get elected to Westminster on multiple occasions. He's like, as the, it wasn't like
he's really on the pulse of the British people, except for everything else he's done.
Yeah, exactly, and kind of like the, there's like a political genius attributed to him because one thing finally went his way, and you can look at it kind of like, oh, well, his positions that he was taking and like all the money Aaron Banks poured into UKIP candidates and stuff went like put pressure on the Conservative government to call the referendum in the first place. And it's like, that's partially true, but you're like, it's untrue to say that Farage caused like was like the mastermind behind the referendum and like etc. and effectively like doesn't have the influence that he seems to think he does. Anyway,
yeah,
unimportant.
Not news.
Similarly, the EU Commission have stated that they're surprised that a letter got leaked, which was David Davis, the Brexit secretary, complaining to Theresa May, the Prime Minister, that the EU had put people in charge of looking into contingency plans for there be no deal, like the UK dropping out of the EU with no trade agreement or anything worked out or divorce settlement, etc., and that they were consulting with companies who were asking about this, and they're saying, well, if there is no deal, here is what can happen. He was complaining about this, despite the fact that he's the one who consistently says that there might be no deal and it actually that wouldn't be that bad a situation, etc. And the negotiations are going well, so it doesn't matter. I'm getting, like, I think there has to be a point at which like leaks of memos and letters from the UK government is no longer interesting because there are so many of them.
I mean, yeah, but they're so juicy with just the nonsense, the absolute nonsense that's within them.
They are juicy, I'll give you that.
Yeah, speaking of nonsense coming out of the UK, Liam Fox is saying that the UK is considering joining a Pacific trade group.
Mm-hmm.
Not entirely sure which one, probably the American-led one. We had a long off-mic discussion about how there's various like trade agreements floating around the Pacific at the moment.
No, he's like specifically said that
it's the American one, is it?
No, well, like as in America's not involved anymore. It's the TPP.
Right.
It's like the one that America is no longer part of.
Okay, interesting. That's a weird one to the, yeah. But there's also like a Chinese-led one. Okay, he's not going to be a part of that, but that Chinese-led one is probably going to take over. Anyway, this is not the Chinese podcast. Anyway, this is weird because the UK, like that whole Pacific trade deal is called the Pacific Trade Deal or like the Trans-Pacific Partnership because the reason the countries that are involved is very much due to the fact that they have access to the Pacific Ocean.
Yep.
Yep. And you'd be surprised to hear that a lot of cargo ships go between them.
Yeah. And you know what's not in the Pacific Ocean? The UK.
Not even a little bit.
Like, I think this is like ridiculous leaks from the UK government and like Liam Fox or the other you know people who should be ineligible to serve in government in the first place due to egregious potentially illegalities in the past, like they say stuff that doesn't make any sense and probably won't happen. Yeah. And people have to report on it and talk about it and take it seriously. But it's like distracting from the fact that like the government as a whole is actually doing very little other than trying to bumble through Brexit negotiations, because obviously that's like the important thing going on. But this is Liam Fox trying to look like, look, I'm not a disgrace to or a national security risk. I've had preliminary talks about this trade negotiation we could be part of. But it's like the TPP would have the same, like, as in part of the anti-Brexit or anti-EU campaign was the EU can force us into stuff like TTIP. The TPP is very similar to TTIP.
Like, there's, for anyone who hasn't been following TPP, which is fair, you're listening to a European political podcast, like, there were lots of protests in, like, in the likes of the United States, Mexico, Australia, New Zealand regarding, like, and probably others in other countries that I don't listen to the news of enough, about this deal. And a lot of the, like, individual caveats of it. And yeah, if Liam Fox is complaining about international agreements the EU can force them in, they were like, they were wholly apart and democratically apart of the EU. They had the ability to stop that if that's not exactly what the Conservatives wanted, which is not true. It's like, international trade agreements is exactly what a lot of the Conservatives in the UK want.
The whole thing, I mean, I think the whole thing of like, a body like the EU has the advantage of, yes, it comes with more bureaucracy than like a trade deal does, but it has the advantage of it's theoretically much easier for you to implement small tweaks on existing trade deals. Whereas in the premise of, oh, well, we can renegotiate this trade deal is like, that would actually have to happen over like 5 or 6 years. And we don't want to renegotiate it. We spent a lot of time negotiating in the first place. Whereas the idea of the EU is that, like, while there's, like, a free market, specifics of how that market works and, like, different tariffs and stuff being removed between countries can be done on a point-by-point basis and be revisited very easily via mechanisms like the Commission and the Parliament. Whereas joining something like the TPP is, they've outlined an agreement and you all have to ratify it, and you could drop out completely from it. You can have the situation which a lot of people think the EU is like you can drop out completely of it, or you can renegotiate it magically somehow. And you're like, that works a lot better with the EU, where they're actually willing to renegotiate stuff, whereas renegotiating the TPP isn't actually like a feasible thing, especially like the UK is a much bigger deal in Europe than it is between, who are the TPP members currently? Australia,
Mexico, Peru, Chile.
Like, it's not a...
A lot of countries that the UK would have to go through another country to get to, type of thing. The other problem with, like, a lot of trade agreements is, I'm not sure how it would shake up, but usually a lot of these international trade agreements have, like, a head honcho nation. Like, before America pulled out, the TPP was getting a lot of, like, countries along the Pacific to normalize their rules with American rules. Similarly, this Chinese one that's, like, trying to take its place, like, China's calling the shots. And there's been similar ones with, like, Central Asian countries with Russia, where Russia is basically calling the shots, and it's, you can't, like, so if the UK enters into a deal where there's another bigger player, unless things are not working for that bigger player, there's not going to be a renegotiation.
This would be signing up like this is an example of, you'd be signing up the UK to a fixed agreement with a lot of stuff that you would know place in negotiating, and a lot of them are exactly as you're saying, like, done in the context of another country's, like, as in another country's legislation, and everyone decided to meet one particular country's version of it and remove tariffs. Like, there's a lot of, like, language specific to it. It wouldn't be the same kind of negotiation and ongoing chain, like, ability to affect change as you get with something like the EU, which is kind of, you know, Liam Fox should be in jail is what I'm saying.
We all agree on that. Anyway, not for this. This is just silly.
Oh, no. This is just him being silly. He should be in jail for that time he massively breached national security by inviting his friend along to confidential security clearance level meetings with arms dealers, etc., for personal gain.
That thing that basically shut down the South Korean government.
Yeah.
That should have happened to Liam Fox.
Yeah. He should be in prison. Anyway, the moral of the story is, it's not news because I don't, like, his department effectively exists to limit the damage Boris Johnson can do. Let's not kid ourselves with Liam Fox actually producing any legislation in the near future.
Previously in Europe is produced by Hugh O'Brien and Kieran Dole. If you liked the show, please leave us a review. And if you've already done that or can't do that for whatever reason, you should tell your friends about it. This kind of stuff helps us a lot. If you're interested in keeping in touch with us or finding out what we're doing during the week, we have a Facebook group. Just search for Facebook Previously in Europe and you'll find us. We post stuff that happens during the week and small silly discussions sometimes. We have a Twitter at Prev in Europe, P-R-E-V in Europe, and we have a Gmail previouslyineurope@gmail.com. You can email us any questions or any thoughts about the show that you want to. We'd love to hear from you. Similarly, where you can find all of this stuff, including our podcasts, is our website, previouslyineurope.eu. Thanks for listening.